in a subject that I've never studied or never taught, was to use the $7,500 sitting in my research account. And so I paid to have a postgraduate student take the tutorials. The penny finally dropped. Because Gillies knew that I had that money in my research account, he assumed that one way or another it would be used for the tutorials. I realized that if Gillies didn't socialize all of the funds from the gastronomy program and gave the Department of History, say, $25,000 or even $50,000 for services rendered, the department would never, never benefit from that money. When it came time to allocate funds to departments for tutors or research maintenance, the dean's office would argue the Department of History already has money that it could spend on tutors or research maintenance. So Mary O'Kane's appeal for departments and faculties to become entrepreneurial to earn funds to support their teaching and research was a misrepresentation of reality in university administrations. I sent a letter to Mary expressing my disappointment. She responded with a short note with an even shorter message. Sorry. She had her own problems and would soon lose her job as a result of the palace coup. According to the contract signed between the university and the Cordon Bleu, and the contract that was developed during the course of 2001, the meeting of the joint committee was responsible for the selection of the program manager. And when it met in November 2001, they confirmed my position as manager for another year. Shortly afterwards, my wife and I flew to the United States to spend Thanksgiving with my 93-year-old father. Unlike the trip to Italy the previous year, I had no feelings of excitement and expectation, only stress and depression. When I returned, Barbara Santich informed me that I had suffered the fate of Mary O'Kane. In a move that violated the contract, Gillies and Control had decided to appoint Barbara as program manager. I was relieved at the outcome, but annoyed at the process. During the first semester of the next year, 2002, I had the highest teaching load that I ever had. I said to myself, so, these are the rewards for being entrepreneurial. The gastronomy program prospered, and the university hired Roger Hayden to help Barbara teach it. I took early retirement at the end of 2003, and Roger became director of the Research Center in 2004. He continued to direct the Research Center until 2009, when the Cordon Bleu and the university failed to renew their contract, which brought an end to the graduate program in gastronomy, an end to the employment of Roger Hayden, and an end to the Research Center for the History of Food and Drink. To end on a positive note, if I had to do it all over again, I would. I consider the Research Center the highlight of my career. I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I met a lot of fascinating people. I made a lot of wonderful friends. I ate a lot of good food. And I drank a lot of good drink. To use academic terms, my world expanded intellectually, socially, and gastronomically. My stomach also expanded. In hindsight, however, I would forget all the crap about being entrepreneurial. And if I saw Andre Quantrill or Malcolm Gillies, I would run the other way. Thank you.
It sounds extremely fascinating and gives some sort of idea of the way we have to deal with change in academic institutions. Pauline's going to talk to us now about the history of science, my ideas and technology group, which I look forward to. I suppose it's the same kind of imaginative thing that we've been hearing about from the others.
It's a happy story.
You're all you sit there.
If you're happy, we'll put them on.
Yes, I'm totally in favour of this technology. Well, the History of Science Ideas of Technology Group began in 1991, so we've been going over 20 years. How did we get started? Well, I was a mature age student doing a PhD with a history of science focus. I'd come out of another career. I was based at the Botanic Gardens Library, which was a fantastic place for a postgraduate student to be. In particular because there was an old-fashioned tea room where everybody, from the director, the director came for morning and afternoon tea, the education officer, the free advisory officer, and people, the scientists came over from the herbarium. It really meant that whatever sort of research problem I'd come across in the course of the morning, I could ask people over morning tea and lunch. It was great. In the history department, by contrast, I was something of a fringe dweller. But with my work experience, I didn't have any trouble making contact with the sort of specialists I needed. I was writing about Schomburg of the Botanic Gardens, and thanks to Peter Byrne's daughter, we have a very beautiful book that came out of the thesis, the Rape of Peter. So it wasn't hard for me to make contact with people, and I'm historians of German settlements, and as I said, but also history of science people interstate. But there was no department or group of this kind in South Australia where you could meet history of science people. There wasn't a university history of science or technology department at any of the three South Australian universities. I spoke to colleagues about the idea of forming a group a bit like the one in Sydney, which I think was the Colonial Science Club, or it was, I don't know if it still exists, someone may tell us. The idea would be to have a group where people with common interests could meet and share ideas. Now, I've worked in the field of public and social administration for years, including the psychiatric work and setting up two community agencies, one of which was in inner city Sydney. The idea of setting up a group in a university setting wasn't particularly daunting, coming from what was a pretty challenging sort of career. I should say my best friend in the course was murdered on the job, so was it, you had to be able to cope with all sorts of things. My recollection is that our first proper meeting was an occasion when we got Professor Rod Holm from the University of Melbourne to come and speak, and we then decided to form a little group. We had backing from people at the herbarium, at the Botanic Gardens, and systematic botanists have got a lot of interest in history of science. In addition, our long-standing treasurer, Dr. Lee Torrett from physics at Adelaide Uni, was supportive. We had two very... I just realised I haven't got... Could you give me a little clock? Just so I can watch the time. Yeah. Thank you. We had Lee, and we had two several geologists supportive, and one of whom had a good deal of experience with an international geological group and with a history of geology group, and he strongly suggested we have a very informal structure. We relied in the first 18 months simply on donations, and one of our meetings, the late Reg Strip from Akarawa put a $50 note in it, and I remember that very fondly. And our aim was to have about four or five meetings a year, maybe the odd excursion, and certainly perhaps combined meetings with the groups. Initially, after that first one, we held our meetings in the club rooms of the Royal Society. Two or three of our committee members were Royal Society Fellows, and I think technically we were a special interest group of the Royal Society. Now, this worked very well until about 2002, when a number of voluntary organisations in South Australia, and you may remember this period, began to be alarmed about the possibility of committee members being sued if there was a freak accident. And I'll give you an example. You will see here this, the notorious, the cable that goes across to the PowerPoint, not taped down. What could happen is that a speaker is here perhaps with his wife, who may not have very strong bones. Somebody in the front row keels over. She rushes forward, she catches her foot in that cord and has a really, really nasty hip or spinal fracture. Her nephew, a young lawyer, says, "We'll sue him." So that is the possibility. You might say it's a small risk, and that person over there is probably pretty safe.
I'd fix this now, I think.
but we tried writing to the Royal Society and really got no reply. I'm not sure if they had good public liability insurance at the time. We simply couldn't get a straightforward reply from them, and you know, the letters just weren't answered. Now, look, given my history and having worked in rehab and all sorts of things, I was not really prepared to take the risk of my committee members, I was president, that the committee members might be sued. They could lose a house if we had a freak accident and a litigious family member. So we simply stopped having meetings for about 6 months. We got legal advice, we talked to people from other history organisations, we negotiated with the university administration. We got ourselves an appropriate constitution and got our society incorporated. The university librarian agreed that we could have our rooms here in the Vowsmith Library, and